This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This recording was made at REACH 2017, held on March 23 and 24, 2017, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
So yes, we live at State College, living on a little farmette there on the edge of town. That was a dream of ours for some time, was to be able to move close to a city and live on the edge of town. We weren't sure how it was going to happen, but whenever All Nations Bible Translation needed someone to come and be the hosts and caretakers for the property, that felt like a perfect fit for us. So we've been there about 3 years now. My goal today is to strengthen your desire to pursue the truth and to encourage you to become more involved in defending the Christian faith. I assume your goal for this session is to get just a bit better and whatever else you're planning for the future, take the next step for being able to better defend your faith. My first experiences defending my faith started in 2010. I had done a bit of evangelism before that, but not to any extent. And that was when I started working for CAM in their billboard and evangelism program. I was about 37 years old at the time, and I had participated in a number of evangelistic efforts at Calvary Bible School in Arkansas, and felt like, you know, getting about the age where I could probably start defending my faith. And this is probably the next thing on the line for me. Little did I realize that I basically knew nothing about defending my faith to unbelievers and skeptics. So I began taking calls from people who passed by on the road and called the billboard number, and did that for a month or so. And then we took a trip to Utah to meet with people there who called our billboards and see about the possibility of a mission or a church getting started there. We spent total of 6 weeks in Utah, 3 different years, 2 weeks at a time. And we talked with a lot of different atheists and Mormons, people with some really strange beliefs, evangelicals who believed that the man who persecuted our forefathers was a really great man. That was Martin Luther. So I quickly had to learn how to defend my faith. And I was confronted with questions that I'd never wrestled with before. They were not easy questions then, and they're not easy questions today. Dealing with these questions completely knocked the props out from underneath of me for a bit as I got into the world of defending my faith. So I've been a seeker ever since, a seeker for truth. And since my early 20s, I've been rather skeptical of folks who have lots of answers and few questions, and I would say now in midlife, I'm even more so. So what I come to you today with is not answers, but more just a few things to guide you along the path. We have a lot of information to go over today, and I suggest that you just star anything that you want to research more in the future. We'll hit the main points going down through this outline, subpoints we won't spend a lot of time on, and that way we can hit the main points and you can use this paper for research in the future if you like. The scholarly term for defending one's faith or beliefs is the word apologetics. It comes from the word apologia. And an apology can be, as we're normally used to this definition, is a regretful acknowledgement of an offense or failure. That's one definition. There's another definition for this word, and that is the defense of one's beliefs or actions against criticism. Apologetics is a demonstration of the correctness of an argument or a belief. There's another word that is sometimes used in this field of study, and that is polemics. Polemics is a critique or attack on the beliefs of other views and religions. So we can attack other religions, but that's probably not going to win a whole lot of people. That's more just letting people know what the truth is. Perhaps you've heard of the story of the North Wind and the Sun, who tried to get someone to take a traveler to take his coat off, and they were going to see who was the most powerful. And so the North Wind blew and blew with all his might, and he could not get this man to take his coat off. The man just wrapped it tighter around him. That's polemics. Apologetics is like the sun. The sun came out, he just poured sunshine over this traveler. Before long, the traveler was taking his coat off. And that is the goal of defending our faith in the field of apologetics. So today we'd like to briefly address two questions. How can Christians explain the basic tenets of Christian belief to people who neither believe nor have any background in its teachings? And how can Christians defend the basic tenets of Christian belief to people who reject or scoff at its doctrines? We have a biblical mandate for giving a defense of the Christian faith in Matthew 28, and that is to go and make disciples of all nations. And in 1 Peter 3, this is a very key verse for our topic today. Peter writes, "But in your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense." That word defense in Greek is apologia. That's where we get this word apologetics. "Always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and respect." The posture that we take is as critical as the words we speak. Jesus was gentle, winsome, and accessible. Say here. Ravi Zacharias says that he's been in situations where a person had some really good stuff to present, but the way they came upon it, the posture that they came into the room, the attitude they had when they were talking to people, totally turned off anything they had to say in the whole session. Paul in 2 Corinthians 10 says, "We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God, and we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ." So first part here would be more polemics. We're demolishing other people's arguments. But then he brings it around to apologetics here in the last half of this verse. We take every captive thought, take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. So our arguments must be more used like swords than like bombs. Our tone, sincerity, care, concern, listening, and respect matter as much as the logic behind what we were saying. Many arguments have been won and lost through the manner in which they were conducted. Another one from Matthew 22. "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and your neighbor as yourself." We have some illustrations from Jesus and how he went about doing this thing of defending the faith to different people. The story of the Good Samaritan. I'm sorry, the Samaritan woman. Jesus is sitting there by a well. This lady comes along. He asks if he could get a drink of water. And from there, they start talking about living water. And from there, they start talking about relationships. And then from there, he goes on to talking about worship. And the result at the end was that many believed. And they said, "We're not believing because of what the Samaritan lady said. They heard the words from Jesus himself and have believed." And so just common, ordinary situations in life are a great time to take the conversation from the natural and gradually work into the spiritual on specific issues that people care about. So Jesus didn't just, he wasn't doing his evangelism presentation to anybody that came by the well. He talked to this lady, he knew something about her. And for us, we don't know about people the way Jesus knew about people. So we're going to have to ask some questions to learn where they're coming from and what they're thinking. Another illustration, Peter's sermon at Pentecost. He just weaves texts from Old Testament scriptures together and made this declaration for the Christian faith. He showed them how that the Old Testament scriptures were being fulfilled in front of them. And this was the person of Jesus whom they were responsible for killing. "Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves know. This is Jesus, delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God. You crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. God raised him up, loosing the pangs of death because it was not possible for him to be held by it." Quite a defense of Christian faith. And then he says, this is his closing clincher, and this is what made them very upset. He says, "Let all the house of Israel therefore know for certain that God has made him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you crucified." And at that point, they were ready to get rid of him. Then we have this story about Paul's discourse on Mars Hill. Now, this is a very different environment than the environment we were just looking at with Jews who knew this Old Testament scriptures. When Paul's on Mars Hill, these people didn't know anything at all about Christianity, perhaps a little bit about Judaism, but likely not. And so he quotes one of their poets, Epimenides of Crete, and he says, you have this quote, "In him we live and move and have our being," and that's the man I would like to tell you about today. So he knew something about their background, and he could use that as a launching pad for what he wanted to talk about. So that brings us to today. Why do we need good apologetics? Why do we need to do well at defending the faith? One day a little boy came to his father and said, "Today the teacher showed us a big round globe. She said it was a model of the world. She said the world was just surrounded by space. How can that be, Dad? What holds up the world? Why doesn't it just fall down?" His father, knowing that this was just a child's question, gave him a child's answer. "It's a camel that holds up the world, son." The boy went away satisfied, for he trusted his father, and for the moment it made sense. He'd seen pictures of camels holding up all sorts of things, so why not the world? But then he got to thinking about it, and by the next day he decided that something was missing in his father's answer. He asked, "Dad, I was just wondering, if a camel holds up the world, what holds up the camel?" His father now thought that he might be in trouble, so knowing that a quick answer turneth away further questions, he said, "It's a kangaroo that holds up the camel." Again, the boy went away, but this time only for a couple of hours. Back again with his father, he asked, "Dad, if a camel holds up the world and a kangaroo holds up the camel, what holds up the kangaroo?" This time the father realized that he was in deep trouble, so he chose the largest animal he could think of. "It's an elephant that holds up the kangaroo." "Come on, Dad," his son retorted, "what holds up the elephant?" The dad saw that this wasn't going to work, so he said, It's elephant all the way down." This story illustrates a very important point. Whatever we believe about anything is built on assumptions that we just take for granted. Now, can somebody tell me what the forces are at work in the universe that holds up the earth and keeps it in place? What are some forces in the universe that keep the earth in place and holds up the world?
Gravity.
Okay, let's keep going. Centrifugal force, density, these are all things that are involved in holding the world up. But what keeps all of those things working smoothly? Where did they come from? Does your worldview have an answer for that? Now, not everybody's worldview has an answer for that. Some people aren't sure what caused the Earth and the stars and the planet to orbit perfectly around each other. Some scientists just refer to it as man's lucky chance. We don't understand. We don't know. All we know is the present. We don't know how this came to be. Some people even think that what we're seeing and realizing is all imaginary. It's just a figment of the mind, and here we are going through our existence. That's hard to imagine for us in Western culture. Now, let's assume for the sake of discussion that this little boy actually believed his dad that it was elephant all the way down. And then let's imagine that someday in school he learns about gravity and centrifugal force and density, and he sees some pictures of the world from outer space, and he's like, "There's no kangaroo. There's no elephant under there." This is going to cause him a lot of concern. It's going to cause him maybe deep distress in his father, because his father taught him something that he couldn't back up. Well, in our schools all over our nation, people are trying to convince children that this world is being held up by all these different forces. They're not explaining the answer as to what made all these forces come together to hold the earth in place. Everything is explained based on what can be observed, and they don't want to go further beyond that. So students are being introduced to a view of reality that is missing the elephant. They know these building blocks underneath, but they can't figure out what it is underneath of that that holds this together. Here's an image portraying what we as Christians believe about this world. We believe that there are unseen hands that created and sustain our world, but we can't prove it. We believe there's evidence to support this belief, but there comes a point at which we just have to make a leap of faith. It's not a blind leap of faith, but it is a leap in the sense that we have to go from what can be seen and touched to the point of believing with our heart and mind. In Colossians 1:17, the Apostle Paul tells us, "And he, Jesus, is before all things, and by him all things consist." So there you have it. That's the elephant that is holding up the world. Most people in North America under the age of 30 have never been taught this. They've never been introduced to that idea whatsoever. They have no idea what holds the earth together. Well, here in America, the last 150 years or so, humanists and scientists have convinced millions of people to believe that God had nothing to do with this earth that we are living on. In America, in 1982, there were 256 million people, and 23 million of them were unbelievers. Just 30 years later, we now have 320, depending on how many people you're counting as visitors, 320 million people in 2015. And at that time, there were 80 million unbelievers. So the amount of unbelievers is going up very fast. This is because of people not knowing what holds our world together. All right, so I'd like to look at six types of responses to the Bible that we may encounter here in our Western culture. First of all, there's people who appreciate the Bible and welcome resources that help confirm what they already believe. So as we're talking to people and they call our billboard number, there's a lot of people that have been exposed to different ideas and thoughts, and they're just calling. They're open to anything they can get from the Bible. They just have very little Bible knowledge and are open to having additional things sent their way or talked about that will help them be stronger in their faith. And we do this a lot. There's a lot of people that just something came along and they saw the number and they're like, "Oh, I bet these guys could probably answer my question." So they call. Then we have people who respect what the Bible says but cannot make sense of their personal experience. So perhaps they have certain feelings about sexuality, and they read the Bible, and it's like, "Well, that's not what I understand." Or maybe they read the Bible that says, a verse that says, "All things work together for good to them that love God," and they're thinking, "My life is not good. This is hell on earth, some fellows tell us. And where is this God? If everything's supposed to work together for good, I'm losing my job, and my wife left me," and on and on. Then there are those who have an inner desire to conform themselves to the character of God, but are not sure who he really is or whether the scriptures are a reliable and sufficient guide for people today. And so they want to do best. They want to do their best. They want to be good people. But how can I know that the God of Christianity is the one we should worship? How do I know whether this Bible is something I can trust in? Then there are those who are somewhat open to God in the Bible, but are just completely unfamiliar with Christianity. We have lots of those in North America that they're open to something if somebody would tell them. They just never had anybody to tell them yet. We used to think of this in foreign countries, but there's millions of them here in our own country at this time. There are those who are quite satisfied with their own religion or belief system, but are curious about what others believe. So this could be an atheist, this could be a Hindu, Muslim, or whatever. Life's going well for them, and don't have any real big questions, but hey, it's good to know what other people believe, and so they ask questions. And then there are those who reject Christianity or any of its teachings and don't want anything to do with Christianity as a whole or a particular teachings of Christianity. They just can't agree with that. So I can agree with this part. This over here, that's just too hard for me to believe. So I'm going to have my hybrid Christianity with some other worldview. Blaise Pascal says there are three kinds of people. There are those who have sought God and have found him, those who are seeking and have not found, and those who neither seek nor find. And then he says, the first are reasonable and happy, the second are reasonable and unhappy, and the third are unreasonable and unhappy. I'm not sure if it's quite that simple, but from a Christian worldview, we believe that anybody who is neither seeking nor finding doesn't understand love and joy and peace to the extent that a Christian does. And so it's our privilege to introduce them to that. All right, what are some reasons for an interest or study in apologetics? First of all, we'll look at some bad reasons. To interact with important or famous people. So there's some pretty highbrow people who are speaking on apologetics around the world, and if you go to the right places, you might get to interact with some of them. If you study apologetics, you could become more intellectual and have more intellectual friends, and then you won't have to hang out with people who just don't get it, who are not as intellectual. That would be a bad reason. Third bad reason is to become educated so that we can intimidate or talk down to people. I've run into this a lot when I'm looking for resources on something. Some people seem to be in this for the whole goal of talking down and intimidating other people to see if they can get them into a trap where they can't answer. There's no point in that. That's not going to bring people in. And lastly, to gain the esteem of men and have people think well of us. All those are bad reasons. If you're interested in defending your faith for those reasons, you need to start over. Here's the good ones. There are people who are not coming to Christ because they're allowing misinformation to cloud their judgment. And there are some people who will choose to place their faith in Christ once this misinformation is cleared away. It's the stuff in their mind that's keeping them from coming to faith. And this happens all the time. People have been fed all kinds of ideas from their parents or their church or their community or their school. And once those things are getting out, are taken out of the way, they're able to have faith. Secondly, people are not coming to Christ because they never heard a clear defense of Christianity. And I'm finding this out more and more as I keep interacting with people. Some people will choose to place their faith in Christ after hearing a clear defense. I still remember back in 2010 talking to a man from Philadelphia, and he called. He was totally open. I asked him if he had any kind of belief. Well, not really. He thinks maybe there's some kind of a higher power. He's quite sure there's probably a higher power. So are you familiar with the Bible at all? No. Did you ever read in it at all? No. And I started asking more questions, and he knew nothing. It just plumb nothing about the Bible. But somehow he got the idea that there's probably some being. And so I sent him a Bible. And we started reading it, starting at Genesis chapter 1, over the phone. And I made a big mistake. I sent him a King James. That was all part of the learning process. So we're stumbling through these big words, and I'm needing to give definitions. I was like, this isn't going to work. We're going to start sending these folks something that they can understand, because he had no clue. All right, third reason. We're commanded to defend the faith. Fourth reason. People are living and dying without Christ. This doesn't necessarily just mean Christless eternity. This means living life on this planet without Christ. Another reason, the media has misrepresented Christianity and put it in a negative light. Any magazine or website anymore you go to with the news will have all kinds of strange articles trying to figure out who Jesus was and the Bible, and it's based on a lot of misinformation. And they're just quoting other people. They're not doing their own research. They're just quoting many other people, and because they want it to be a certain way. And lastly, the majority of Christians have misrepresented Christianity and put it in a negative light. So anybody who's really opposed to Christianity, you can go and ask them whether they've had bad experience with Christians, and almost all of them have. And so because of that, we need good apologetics. Threat of apostasy. Oh, sorry, I got two more here yet. The threat of apostasy is always present, so we need to keep our faith articulated so that even people growing up in our own churches know what they believe and are prepared to handle things that they might hear or learn from society. And we have morality being redefined by scientists, psychologists, and sociologists. And institutions of higher learning are often hostile to Christianity. Now, not all are. I had a friend that went to school in the arts world, and he went there for 8 years. He said there was never a comment made at all about there not being a God. It's just that he was never mentioned in the whole 8 years. And that's why he began to think that, oh, I guess life kind of goes on without God in these people's world, and it started affecting him as well. All right, the need for Christian lay apologists. A lay apologist is one who meets with individuals or small groups to answer their questions and help them think. Anybody can be a lay apologist. The world could benefit from millions of lay apologists. Lay apologists likely bring more people to Christ than skilled public apologists. Lay apologists meet people who would never attend a public apologetic meeting. And lay apologists can go places that public apologists cannot. Nothing can take the place of personal encounters and conversations. So apologetics can be both informational and incarnational. Informational means helping people understand the truth about any matter so that they can better believe, better understand. I talked about getting rid of these misconceptions and misunderstandings so that it clears their mind to be able to focus on the truth. Incarnational apologetics is something on the same level as maybe what you've heard as friendship evangelism. Incarnational apologetics is being Christ to people here on earth. It's giving a defense for the Christian faith by the way we live. It helps people understand that we are real flesh and blood human beings. So these are some Chinese we were studying the Bible with about a year ago. And we would sit in our house, in our living room there, and we would go over informational apologetics. This was brand new stuff to them. They'd never heard anything about the Bible before. And so they're asking lots of questions. But then we also did things like this. We took them sledding and helped them know that this isn't just something intellectual. This is something that affects the way we live and affects our lives. I'd like to read you a email that this lady sent us after we went sledding. This is her way of writing. "Hi, Ernest. I wonder if that's appropriate. I hope you help me or give me some advice. It's about my daughter's education. I most like is Carmen, your daughter. She is courtesy, warm-hearted, self-confidence. I hope my daughter turn into a girl like your Carmen. You and Kathy cultivate kids successfully. I think maybe it's me so impatient, and maybe I must do my work, then know enough time to teach Suya. Now I attempt to give her another environment. So I want Suya can live in a family like yours. Maybe some other kids can affect her do better. I can do something or pay for her, express my gratitude. For example, in the weekend I send her out. Would you mind help me find a family can help me do that? Don't you think I'm crazy? Sorry for my crazy. I only hope my daughter more politeness. I believe you and your wife Kathy so much. Please don't hesitate to give me some advice." And so our daughter Carmen is no angel. She has as much of the old nature as any child does. And if you lived around her for 24 hours, you would see some of that. But there's no doubt that she has caught a vision for reaching out to people. And she wants to be a good example of Christianity, the best that she can. And we found that there are numerous Chinese mothers and fathers, but particularly mothers, who have come to us wanting to know how to do child training. We had no idea that that would be a way to an in with international people. But these Chinese have been living with the one-child policy for so long that they have a bunch of spoiled brats and they don't know what to do with them. And the parents are off working. We have the same problem in the United States. It's just that the United States, we've come to accept this as normal. China is still not to that place yet. They still have enough of the old cultural values, respect for authority and so forth, that they realize that something is wrong. That it shouldn't be this way. And yet they're adapting to Western culture. And so they're still aware of it. So let's give that as an example of how incarnational apologetics does just as much as the things that we're trying to teach them. Let's go to clues to the existence of God. So somebody says, how can you know that there's a God? How can you prove it to me? Well, there's a lot of clues to the existence of God. Now, someday God says that he's going to make it very plain that he is God. Every knee will bow. He hasn't made it that plain at this point, but he has given sufficient evidences for us to know that he exists. And so we're going to talk about several clues here. So we have the study of being, the ontological argument. And this is if you enjoy philosophy and logic, so I'm not going to get into it, but I'm just going to mention it here as we go along. We have the clue of creation. And the basic conclusion is that the universe had a cause because whatever begins to exist as a cause. Clue from design. The creation exists in great complexity and demonstrates regularity. Therefore, the universe is a product of an intelligent designer. Then we have the clue of fine-tuning. We have a universe that's designed for life. And just incredible odds for this to come together, for a world to be designed for life. Francis Collins, who is head of a National Institute of Health, says, "The limitations of science will tell me a lot about how things work. It will not tell me why we're here and what the purpose is in life or what happens after we die. For that, I need my faith. And I'm grateful to be able to draw upon both of those ways of knowing in order to have a full appreciation of the wonderful gift of life that we've been given." So I'll just play a recording here of one of our phone team members talking to a man about this very subject. If we can get it to work.
My name is John Martin. How are you today?
Hello?
Yes, I'm assuming you saw one of our billboards.
I did. I was curious. It says there is evidence for the existence of God, and I was curious as to what that evidence was.
Okay, I want you to note the word is evidence, not proof, because right. the existence of God cannot be absolutely proved, and neither can his non-existence be absolutely proved. So all of us look at the same evidence, and then we have to make a decision and take a step of faith, because we don't have absolute proof, so we have to look at the direction the evidence is going and then finally step into that reality that we believe the evidence points to. So here it is.
Okay.
I think you saw a baby on that sign?
I believe so, yes, sir.
Now, the baby began, of course, with a fertilized cell, and in that cell was a DNA that described every aspect of that baby. They say that if you printed out that DNA code, it would fill 500,000 pages of text, more volume of material than you would find in the Britannic Encyclopedia, arranged in a very complex order. And I say that if we received a message like that from outer space, all the scientists would be hailing that as evidence that there was intelligent life out there. And yet they see it in every one of the 10 trillion cells in our body. And they say that doesn't prove anything about intelligence. So there's one piece of evidence, plus many other things like that.
So you're saying that the DNA having such a great extent of material within it, just the one code, that if we were to receive a message like that from outer space, that we would consider that to be evidence of intelligent life, therefore DNA is evidence of God?
Yes, I say it's evidence of supernatural intelligence.
Oh. Of supernatural intelligence?
Well, it's just an incredible volume of information to begin with, and then the complexity of that helix.
So these are the kinds of conversations that our phone team are having every day of the year. Some of these conversations last an hour or two, and there are people who are coming to faith by discussing these things and getting rid of some of those misconceptions. Okay, well, we're going to have to wind this down. I have a lot of information here about the reliability of the Bible, the historical Jesus. These are some very crucial things that you have to get in order. So if a person doesn't believe that the Bible is true, first of all, I have to get them to believe that it's a reliable book. It's a reliable historic book. And there's much more reason to believe in the Bible as a reliable historical book than other old documents from that time period, because we have a lot of information that was written down right after it happened. Homer, for instance, was like 900 years after. That's the earliest copy we have. Yet people believe Homer, you know. And so you first of all have to get them to understand that this is a reliable historical book. And then you have to try to prove to them that Jesus was a real person and that the stories about him are true. And so if you've already established that the Bible is true, then you can go to talking about the historical Jesus. Some of the charges they bring against us, page 4. they would say, why do you think you have to be so snobbish? There's a lot more religions around than yours. Why do you have to be so exclusive? And so they talk about the apparent errors in the Bible. There are errors in the Bible, in case you didn't know that. And I list some of the conclusions people come to here on page 4. Page 5 talks about the exclusivity of Christ and why it's perfectly reasonable that we say that Christianity is the only way. Jesus made that claim, so we're not the ones that are trying to make that claim. And, you know, other prophets did not make that claim, but Jesus did. So C.S. Lewis says there's three options. Either he was a liar, he wasn't telling the truth when he made these claims, or else he's a lunatic. He was out of his mind. You can't say he's a good prophet and a lunatic at the same time. So a lot of people say, yeah, he's a good prophet, but I just don't believe he is deity. Well, he's not a good prophet if he makes claims like this about being divine. So he's a liar, or he's a lunatic, or he's a lord. Page 6, halfway down. One of the unique things we have as Anabaptist people is to defend our particular brand of Christianity. And I've found this to be very helpful for people who are having struggles with faith. Most of them, like I said, had some problem with a Christian or with Christianity in general. So somebody that's really irate with Christianity, I've asked them already. So have you ever met someone who really reminded you of Jesus? The way he thought, the way he acted, the way he lived. You just that fellow just sounds like that man I read in the Bible, you know, Jesus. And without fail, they always say they don't know of a person like that. And then I tell them, well, you have the opportunity of your life coming yet to meet one of them. I have lots of friends that remind me of Jesus. And no, we don't do it perfectly, but, you know, there's people that don't go to war and we don't fight and we love our enemies. And they're like, really? And their interest is very perked up at that point. Okay, maybe you have some questions.
Do you see much variations between an older generation and younger generation, specifically millennials, in the way that they process information and what is truth?
So the question is, do I see a difference between the older generation and the younger generation in terms of the millennials in the way that they process truth? Yes, definitely. So postmodernism started about 1950, and they started questioning the old ways of knowing truth. So in the early part of the earlier part of the 20th century, modernism was the big thing, and everybody was defending things based on logic. And so your old hardened atheists that we talk to on the phone tend to be of that mindset, where they're defending everything logically and philosophically. Your younger generation, the millennials, are going to say, I'm just open, you know. Now, don't tell me that yours is the only way, but, you know, tell me about your religion. And so they're much more open in that sense, I would say. Yes? Okay, good. So we now mail New King James to people that don't specifically want a King James. So that's much easier to understand. There's a whole range of translations. So I personally like the New King James or the ESV as a translation that's pretty word for word. Now there's something like New Living Translation that's going to be much more accessible, but it's not word for word, and it's influenced with a lot of evangelical theology. And so the way they explain things isn't going to be based on the Bible the way I understand it, but it's still a way for them to understand some of it. So I would say if you're really studying the Bible and you want to know what it says, then go with something like New King James or ESV. If you're just trying to get an overall sense of what the Bible's about, what kind of book it's like, you know, there's other ones that are more of a paraphrase that can be helpful. Anybody else? Okay. I'm just curious, what are you involved in? Why'd you come to this class? What kind of people are you talking to that you're hoping to defend your faith with better? Just some quick answers.
Jewish people in New York City.
Okay.
Young people.
What age?
From about 11 to 20.
Okay. It's a great chance to plant some truth there.
I'm not relating with anybody, but I just wanted to find out more about it.
Sure. Well, if you ever need some opportunities, you're welcome to come up to Penn State. We have about 100 different countries represented there and about 40 to 45,000 students. So we have pretty much every different kind of belief there. We found that a lot of the Asians, Africans, Mideasterners enjoy hanging out with us because our family life, our values are more similar to theirs. And so it's a great way to just engage them with that.
So I have a question.
Yes.
When in speaking to someone defending your faith, do you find it easier or better to tell your story or to present the truth of the gospel about that as a teenager? Often
it's both. I'm not saying that one comes before the other. Kind of just rely on the Holy Spirit and feel your way with that. But some people, they're gonna say, your story doesn't matter to me at all. Everybody has a story. Muslims have their story. Mormons have their story. I want to know the hard facts. And then there's other people who are saying, I don't really care about the details. I just want to know, does this make any difference? Anybody else? Okay, I have a number of books back here on the table. That's on this list here at the end. You're welcome to browse them today or tomorrow if you are interested. There's some handouts there. And if you didn't get your email address on the sheet we were passing around here and you'd like some things emailed to you, you can do that before you leave. And thank you for your attention.
This recording and many others are available from Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. For more information, call 1-814-789-4769 or visit us online at www.christianlearning.org.